It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, from donations to the Clinton Foundation to President Obama's reaction to the Baltimore riots, we'll get the latest in national politics. Now we head to Washington for our weekly roundup of national politics. As Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign gets into gear, new reports show that the Clinton Foundation failed to disclose 1,100 foreign donations.
In Congress, Senate Republicans are trying to amend a bill that would give Congress a say on the final Iran nuclear agreement, but some of their colleagues in the Senate say those amendments could derail Congress's influence in the process altogether.
And as the National Guard continues to patrol the streets of Baltimore, we'll look at what President Obama has had to say. Here with us now is David Friedlander, senior political correspondent at The Daily Beast. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the story about the Clinton Foundation. 1,100 donors, I said foreign. I don't know that we know that because they're undisclosed. But let's unpack that. What was the expectation of the foundation? Why is this raising hackles here?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's been a steady drip, drip, drip over the last, really, you know, several weeks or even months about what the foundation was doing. A lot of what it centers around is that when Hillary Clinton joined the State Department, she signed an agreement with the White House that they would disclose all of their donors, foreign donors especially, just in order to make sure that everything was sort of above board with now her work, you know, at government and her husband's work with the foundation. Recently, it was discovered that this sort of subsidiary of the Clinton Foundation that was based in Canada had been apparently accepting foreign donations all along. And the explanation for that was because it was in Canada and didn't have the same disclosure requirements.
So was the concern from the outset that, hey, you've got this Secretary of State and then you've got this foundation she's connected to, was there worry that a donation to the foundation would influence her behavior in government?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That it would be a way to somehow, you know, lobby the family, lobby Hillary Clinton, without actually, you know, getting to her or doing anything untoward, was by holding high level meetings at the foundation or giving money to the foundation. And you know, it hasn't sort of been proven yet that she did anything on behalf of foundation donors while Secretary of State. But clearly there have been incidents that raise flags.
Right. So even if there aren't laws broken here, it may turn out there were or weren't. But the phrase, the appearance of impropriety, is that the worry for a presidential campaign that's just getting off the ground?
Yeah, for sure. You know, I don't think anybody is really talking about any laws being broken here. It's really just about this agreement that was made with the White House. To disclose the foundation's fundraising and the foundation's doings, and that agreement appears to not have been kept.
This is kind of a unique situation. We've got a presidential candidate married to a former president. They've both been involved in some of the same nonprofit activity, including this foundation. Do we have a template for this kind of thing based on recent history?
Not that I can think of. I mean, we certainly have, you know, foundations and presidents and people connected to presidents like the Bushes. I mean, they have foundations and charitable work they're connected with. I don't think there's anything that's quite like the Clinton Foundation, which is this grown into this sprawling global concern over the last 15 or so years. So it's certainly unique.
One of the last critiques we've heard of Hillary Clinton was over the use of a private email server during her time at the State Department. One difference here is that then she didn't have an official campaign. Now she does. How has that changed the way that she can respond to this kind of story?
Well, they're really not responding to it. I mean, they seem to be taking these blows and kind of letting them, you know, just letting them glance off and hoping that, I think, that they kind of get into the partisan conversation where if you're a Republican, you know, you think everything is wrong. If you're a Democrat, you think the Republicans are overstepping just like they did, you know, in Whitewater or Benghazi or whatever else. I mean, I think the one interesting thing about the emails and the way they're connected here is, of course, we can't really independently verify what she knew, when she knew it, who she met with, because some of those emails were destroyed during that process.
So what are you hearing from Republicans as this goes on? Have they been pouncing on this issue already in the presidential race?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they're using it to paint, you know, Hillary Clinton is inherently untrustworthy, secretive, kind of trying to play into, I think, a larger story about the Clintons, that they're two-faced and that they're sort of out of touch with reality.
We are talking to David Friedlander with the Daily Beast about the top issues in national politics, starting off with Hillary Clinton's campaign, accusations over sort of non-disclosure, I guess, at the Clinton Foundation, and we'll get to some other issues as well in just a few. Now, David, let's turn to the Senate now, looking at amendments to the Iran Nuclear Review Act. This is a bill that would require Congress to have a say in the United States' final agreement with Iran over its nuclear capability. What are some Republicans doing when it comes to amendments to this?
It seems like what they're trying to do is, you know, Republicans and Democrats came together to really create a framework agreement that the White House had no choice but to accept, basically giving the Senate oversight over whatever agreement is struck with Iran by the White House. However, I think as often happens in these cases is it appears as if that agreement that Republicans and Democrats forged in the Senate is now coming under threat by probably people's political aspirations, who are trying to say that, this deal gives away too much. We're giving away too much to the Obama administration to make the deal. And so they're pushing back.
We'll get into more on Iran in just a moment. Talking about the top news in national politics, David Friedlander stays with us, senior political correspondent at the Daily Beast.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our weekly look at the latest in national politics, talking to David Friedlander, senior political correspondent at the Daily Beast. David, earlier you were talking about amendments offered and mostly rejected to what Congress can say about an Iran deal. What do you think is the likely outcome of all this when all is said and done in Congress?
Oh, gosh. You know, that's a great question. I'm always sort of loath to make predictions. I think they probably end up sticking to the agreement that they forged. One can never get too far ahead of oneself with this Congress.
Nothing to put money on.
Right.
We'll move to the rioting in Baltimore after a week of peaceful protests there. Yesterday, the president spoke about events in Baltimore and what was supposed to be a press conference with the prime minister of Japan. Here's a little of what he had to say.
But I think we as a country have to do some soul searching. If we think that we're just going to send the police to do the dirty work of containing the problems that arise there without, as a nation and as a society, saying what can we do to change those communities, to help lift up those communities and give those kids opportunity, then we're not going to solve this problem.
Just part of ultimately a six-point talk he gave. The president, David, is often criticized for not coming out strong enough on police violence, going too far on race, depending on who you're talking to. What do you make of what he had to say this time around?
Remarkable moment in a way. I mean, he knew exactly what he wanted to say. I think he had it written out on a piece of paper, those 6 points, in response to a reporter's question at a Rose Garden ceremony, essentially. And I think what I thought was interesting was, he made sure to sort of, on the one hand, cast blame and credit where blame and credit were due, but on the other hand, say, this is a problem that is ongoing and that we just can't focus on when there's a riot going on. And then if we think that police are going to solve the problem of our inner cities, we are wrong.
Do you think the president is going to focus more on issues of police and minority group tensions in the remaining small portion of his presidency?
I would assume so. I mean, I think he said then that he was under no illusions that this Congress would move much to take up this cause. But I would also just point out that there's a post-presidency to come, and we don't yet know how he's going to be spending that time. But it wouldn't surprise me if this was something that took up his interest.
Now, the latest economic numbers came out today. The first quarter of 2015, the country's GDP, gross domestic product, grew 0.2% compared to an expected 1%. So it was expected to be not great. It was even less than not great. What's been the political response to these numbers? Are people making a lot of this or saying, it was just the weather, not a big deal?
Yeah, I think people are aware of that one should avoid the tendency to sort of overthink one data point when discussing the economy. I mean, clearly the economy is so much better than it was in 2007, 2008. Many indicators seem to be that it continues to slowly improve as well. Certainly certainly it's the Democrats' hope that it does. But I tend to think that it's a mistake to just sort of focus on the most recent numbers and think that that's indicative of a trend.
Now, the last time a Clinton ran for president, the catchphrase from the campaign was, "It's the economy, stupid." Is it the economy this time in the presidential race?
Yeah, I think it really will be. I mean, it seems as if Hillary Clinton's prospects will probably rise or fall depending on the economy, for sure.
Yeah, that's been a question. Like, how much is Hillary Clinton's campaign, Obama term three, how much does she rise or fall based on what things look like when the president leaves office?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there's anybody rooting harder for a better and more robust economy than the folks at the Clinton headquarters in Brooklyn.
To what extent do they need to distinguish themselves, though, and say, we're not Obama 3, we're Clinton 1 or Clinton 2, part 1?
You know, my sense from talking to folks there is that they are very aware that they really can't do that. They're not sure they would want to. I mean, Obama remains a pretty popular figure, especially among Democrats, especially among African-American Democrats and Hispanic Democrats, both constituencies which they think they'll need. They know they can't ever distance themselves really from Obama. I mean, I think there'll be some differences on foreign policy, but I also don't think they want to.
Do you think we'll see, we're seeing a couple of Democratic challenges to Hillary Clinton in this primary race. Do you think anyone is going to step up that has a chance to make a run of this?
Well, it depends on what you mean by has a chance and make a run, I guess. Certainly all polling at the moment looks like this is, to say Hillary Clinton to lose is probably understating it, frankly. I mean, she is a massive, massive front runner. It's as if she were the incumbent. I think yesterday it was reported that Bernie Sanders, the independent socialist senator from Vermont, will be challenging her. And he can certainly make for an interesting race, but whether or not he actually, you know, is able to get the votes and the delegates to make it close is another story.
And just briefly on the Republican side of things, some polling from Iowa this week showing Wisconsin's Scott Walker out 10% lead in that state, I should say. Any thoughts on the state of the art in the Republican side of things, given that there's a long time to go before the first voting?
There's a long time to go. I mean, I think we're seeing a race on the Republican side that's really settling into sort of two tiers, where there's Governor Walker, Jeb Bush, and Marco Rubio seem to be the early front runners, and then there's a sort of Ted Cruz, Rand Paul with maybe a little bit of a longer shot, and a bunch of folks who seem to, you know, have a much more limited chance.
A lot to watch. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you.
We've been talking to David Friedlander. He's senior political correspondent at the Daily Beast for this edition of our weekly roundup of the latest in national politics.